top stories, Iran dismisses as quote politically motivated statements and unsubstantiated allegations. The US and UK claims that Tehran was behind the attack on an Israeli-managed tanker. The UN warns that hundreds of thousands of civilians are facing emergency levels of hunger in two conflict-ridden regions in northern Ethiopia. Coronavirus cases and hospitalizations in the US, fueled by the rapid spread of the Delta variant, jumped to their highest numbers in 6 months. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran has once again rejected the US and UK allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations, Zahra Irshadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated and unsubstantiated. She was responding to anti-Iran statements by the US and the UK in a Security Council meeting on Monday. Irshadi said there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the accusations and called them the repetition of fabrications by the Israeli regime. She noted that the regime that has carried out attacks on over 10 commercial vessels in regional waters in the last 2 years cannot whitewash its terrorist acts with such accusations. Irshadi urged the council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which, as usual, are blindly supported by certain Western countries.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the officials said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli-managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. The regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move. Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman says the U.S. and its allies have so far failed to provide clear proof backing their accusations against Iran.
When Iran says, well, fine, let's see some proof that we did this, the United States and its running dogs simply can't manage it. Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, is a Jew and presumed Zionist. And his counterpart in the United States, Antony Blinken, is also a Jew and presumed Zionist. And they've got their poodles walking along behind them, the rest of the European countries, Germany, France, and so forth. And they don't bother to say, well, where is the proof? It's kind of like a parrot with a mental problem. It's, you know, we have proof, we have proof, we have proof. And when you say, well, show us the proof, all you get back is, we have proof, we have proof, we have proof. So it's very similar to the uproar that the Americans and the British and the Saudis orchestrated when there were attacks on Saudi oil refineries in the Eastern province. And attacks by Yemenis on various Arab installations in Saudi Arabia. And they were always, oh, this is Iran, this is Iran, this is Iran. And denigrating entirely the ability of the Yemenis to fight back against their Saudi oppressors.
An Israeli Dolphins-class submarine has reportedly crossed the Suez Canal into the Red Sea amid rising tensions over a recent attack on an Israeli-owned tanker off Oman. An informed Iranian security source said two Israeli warships have also entered the Red Sea, adding that they are probably escorting the submarine, which is moving stealthily. The source stressed that the Israeli military's move is aimed at creating tensions in the region. Tel Aviv and its Western allies blamed Iran for the tanker attack without providing any substantial evidence. Tehran has already denied the accusation and has warned that it would respond decisively to any move against its national interests. The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the collapse of the Israeli regime is imminent, stressing that it will be materialized in the near future. Major General Hossein Salami made the speculation in separate meetings with the heads of Palestinian resistance movements, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The top commander said recent developments in Palestine, particularly Operation Al-Quds Sword by resistance groups in May, shattered the idea of Israel's invincibility and the need for coexistence with the occupying regime. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, for his part, said the situation in the region is changing in favor of resistance movements as they are growing more and more powerful. The Islamic Jihad leader Ziad al-Nakhala also hailed Iran as a defense shield for the Muslim world and the resistance front in the region. Iran's local vaccine Coviran has launched the second production facility. The biotech firm says the second line will more than quadruple the production capacity, which currently stands at 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Starting almost a year ago as the first viable Iranian vaccine candidate, Coviran is now a household name in Iran. After passing all the clinical trials, Coviran launched its first production line 3 months ago and now has inaugurated the second line, which will more than quadruple the output capacity to roughly 15 million doses per month.
The second facility is larger than the first production line. It went operational today and will add some 8 million doses to the current capacity, getting the overall output to between 12 and 1 million doses a month. This will cover much of our domestic demand for vaccines.
With U.S. sanctions casting their shadow on the import of vaccines into Iran, the inoculation program has been slow in the country. The Delta variant has now swept across Iran, killing at least 400 people every day. Coviran says it is speeding up its efforts to produce as many jabs as possible to stem the tide of Delta, as they claim their vaccine can terminate the new variant.
There is a test called virus neutralization test, or VNT, which studies how much a vaccine can protect the body against a virus. The Delta variant has not yet proven to be vaccine evading, but based on VNT experiments conducted on Coviran, it can neutralize the Delta variant as well.
So far, Coviran has produced and administered 7 million doses. The biotech firm says it will launch a third production facility, which will add 10 million more doses each month, boosting the overall output to 25 million. Given a monthly domestic demand of less than 15 million, Coviran says the extra doses will be exported to other countries.
Coviran developers say their vaccine has so far covered 35% of the entire vaccination program in the country. They hope with the launching of the second production line here, the government will no longer need to rely on foreign jabs to inoculate its citizens. Yusuf Jalali from Kopiran Production Facility in Alborz Province.
The United Nations has warned about emergency levels of hunger in conflict-ridden northern Ethiopia, saying hundreds of thousands face an acute shortage of food in the region. The World Food Programme said some 300,000 civilians in the regions of Amhara and Afar are falling deeper into hunger as a result of the conflict. The UN had previously said about 400,000 people face famine-like conditions in Tigray itself. The warning comes as the war continues to expand and officials report fresh civilian casualties in the north. Northern Ethiopia has been racked by fighting since November, when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent troops to topple the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The federal government had accused forces loyal to then-ruling party of the Tigray region of attacking army camps. Hundreds of people in Greece have gathered outside Parliament in the capital, Athens, to protest the government's handling of wildfires raging across the country. The demonstrators criticized authorities for a lack of funding for special firefighting units, vehicles, and resources. The crowd, that included members of leftist and environmental organizations, also slammed the government for its unfavorable policies towards the environment. In the meantime, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has apologized for what he called the weaknesses in responding to wildfires on the island of Evia.
The extent of the destruction, especially in Evia and Attica, blackens all of our hearts, and I'm the first one to apologize for whatever weaknesses existed. I completely understand the pain of our citizens, who saw their houses and property burning, the upheaval of having to abruptly leave their homes.
Mitsotakis said his country is facing a natural disaster of unprecedented dimensions. He pledged that these people who have lost their homes and property will be compensated and the burnt areas will be reforested. Greek authorities are currently dealing with over 580 wildfires across the country amid soaring heat and dry conditions. The blazes on the island of Evia have destroyed several homes and businesses and forced thousands to flee to safety by sea. The rapidly spreading Delta variant of COVID-19 across the United States has pushed the country's cases and hospitalizations to a six-month high. Infections in the U.S. have averaged 100,000 for 3 days in a row. The number shows a 35% increase over the past week. Based on the population, the states of Louisiana, Florida, and Arkansas reported the most new cases in the past week. The United States remains the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic, with nearly 36 million cases and over 617,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Brazil reported more than 12,000 new infections and over 400 deaths on Monday, bringing its overall cases to more than 20 million and the death toll to over 563,000. The UK government is deporting another group of people of Jamaican descent to the Caribbean country. The move has caused an outcry among migrant rights advocates, who say the move is unfair and politically motivated. Our London correspondent Saeed Poreza has more.
Another episode in the British government's harsh immigration policy. A deportation flight planned for August 11th. On board, 19 people of Jamaican origins in this country for up to 30 years now.
The UK Home Office, responsible for immigration, has called those deportees foreign offenders, people who have come here and committed crimes and should expect to be removed.
But immigrant rights groups such as the Movement for Justice say the move is a reversal of an earlier agreement between the UK and Jamaican governments not to deport people who arrived in the UK as minors.
These are not people who should be deported. I deal very often with people who have lived in the country as children, or who have lived here for a very, very long time, or have been convicted of offences that aren't at the most serious end of the offences. So I have seen people for low-level drug dealing, not necessarily condoning it, but it is low-level drug dealing. There's all sorts of ideological and expert, you know, sort of, I suppose, societal issues why that sometimes happens to people.
Some are believed to be relatives of the Windrush generation, citizens of the British Empire who traveled to Britain between 1948 and 1973, after the government called on its colonies to send workers to help rebuild the country after World War II.
They came in the 1950s, have really gotten the short end of the stick. And remember, their ancestors have already been through slavery and colonialism and neo-colonialism and governorships and all sorts of awful systems that has always put them as second-class citizens. Then they came here, and they were treated as second-class citizens. We've seen that with the Windrush scandal. And it is their children and grandchildren who are now being shackled and put on those planes. It's, you know, a further denigration of their rights.
Last year, 50 Britons of Jamaican descent were also forcibly removed. Many grew up in the UK. The hashtag Jamaica50 is still remembered.
People watching see the way that this government holds in such disrespect the contribution of West Indian, Caribbean, and black people in this country. When will black lives matter once again?
The British government claims the deportations are everything to do with public safety or protecting victims. But rights campaigners disagree. They say the move is purely racist and political, made by a failing government appealing desperately to its racist base. Saeed Fariza, London.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Trump-era tariffs on Chinese imports are fueling record U.S. inflation and threaten President Joe Biden's chances at 2022 midterm elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman. The piece is titled, U.S. Business Pushes Biden for a China Trade Deal. The article has appeared on the front page of AsiaTimes.com website. Never before in U.S. political history has the whole of the American business community, more than 30 major business organizations, spoke with one voice, as it did in an 5th of August appeal to the Biden administration to eliminate tariffs on imports from China. No entities in American politics are timider than business lobbies, most of whose work involves quiet lobbying for administrative relief and legislative tweaks. Such a high-profile intervention suggests that the business organizations believe that a deal is already underway. A deal is likely because inflation could poison the Democratic Party's chances at 2022 midterm elections and return control of the U.S. Congress to the Republicans. Cutting tariffs is the quickest way to reduce inflation. Beyond the arithmetic of electoral politics, consensus is emerging that the technology sanctions that Trump imposed on China have failed and may even have backfired. More than 30 business groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the Semiconductor Industry Association, as well as retailers, farm and manufacturing representatives, asked President Biden to cut tariffs and restart trade talks with China. The letter stated, a worker-centered trade agenda should account for the cost that U.S. and Chinese tariffs impose on Americans here and at home and remove tariffs that harm U.S. interests. Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told the New York Times that tariffs hurt American consumers. Since then, former President Donald Trump imposed a 20% tariff on roughly half the goods America buys from China. The Treasury Department has collected about $100 billion in fees. Most of that was paid by U.S. consumers. Tariffs explained part of the explosion in durable goods inflation during the past year. Consumer prices for durable goods fell steadily between 1995 and 2020, mainly due to lower costs for electronics. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, for durables fell by 25% between 1997 and 2020, before rebounding by 15% since the COVID-19 lockdown. Falling prices for U.S. imports from China had a big impact on the prices Americans paid for durable goods. According to a Vox Data for Progress poll released on 3rd of August, inflation is the most pressing economic issue for American voters. The United States now imports about $550 billion a year from China, or almost a quarter of America's manufacturing output of $2.4 trillion on a GDP basis. Tariffs of 20% apply to about half of Chinese imports, so by simple arithmetic, the elimination of tariffs should reduce the cost of durable goods in the United States by a bit over 2%. Renmin University professor Jin Kan Rong, a prominent Chinese academic closely followed in Washington, argued recently that inflation could bankrupt the U.S. federal government by boosting the cost of interest on the federal debt. He added that the U.S. needs China's supply chains to keep inflation under control. China's state-controlled English-language newspaper Global Times commented on 6 of August. U.S. high tariff policy is against the trend of the times and will not hold for long. Chinese companies have generally adapted to the new situation, while the U.S. is suffering more from the tariffs than China. This has gradually become a consensus in U.S. public opinion, and this has given China better conditions to maintain its strategic focus. In fact, it is also an increasingly clearer manifestation of China's comprehensive strength. Meanwhile, an increasing number of American strategists have concluded that former U.S. President Donald Trump failed to slow China by cutting off access to high-end semiconductors made with U.S. technology. Asia Times recently was the first to report that China had the semiconductor capacity to work around American sanctions for critical applications, such as 5G network build-out, and that China was moving rapidly to exploit fifth-generation in a wide range of industries. China will build nearly a million fifth-generation 5G base stations this year, vastly outpacing the rest of the world combined. Moreover, Chinese industry sources report that tens of thousands of dedicated fifth-generation networks for factories, ports, warehouses, mines, and urban transportation systems will be installed in the course of the next year. In a July 2021 report on China's semiconductor industry, the U.S. Semiconductor Industry Association wrote, "Just recently, China sent astronauts into space to board a new space station. Earlier this year, China landed a rover on Mars." Chinese state media reported that inside both China's space station and the Mars rover were 100% indigenously designed and produced semiconductors, signaling China's increasingly sophisticated microchip capabilities. Nevertheless, while China has mastered some chip technologies, its commercial semiconductor industry is still relatively nascent. Still, the Chinese government is making serious efforts to close the gap, investing well over $150 billion from 2014 through to 2030 in semiconductors. Buoyed by a booming market and these government investments, China is poised to be increasingly competitive in some semiconductor market segments. In a 4th of August commentary for Project Syndicate, Harvard professor Graham Allison and former Google chief executive officer Eric Schmidt warned, "Most Americans assume that their country's lead in advanced technologies is unassailable, and many in the U.S. national security community insist that China can never be more than a near-peer competitor in artificial intelligence. In fact, China is already a full-spectrum peer competitor in terms of both commercial and national security artificial intelligence applications. China is not just trying to master artificial intelligence, it is mastering artificial intelligence. The pandemic has offered a revealing early test of each country's ability to mobilize artificial intelligence at scale in response to a national security threat." In the United States, President Donald Trump's administration claims that it deployed cutting-edge technology as part of its declared war on the coronavirus. But for the most part, artificial intelligence-related technologies have been used mainly as buzzwords. Not so in China. To stop the spread of the virus, China locked down the entire population of Hubei province, 60 million people. That is more than the number of residents in every state of U.S. East Coast, from Florida to Maine. China maintained its massive cordon sanitaire by using artificial intelligence-enhanced algorithms to track residents' movements and scale up testing capabilities while massive new healthcare facilities were being built. Asia Times broke the story of China's use of artificial intelligence for pandemic control on 3rd of March 2020. China suppressed COVID-19 with artificial intelligence and big data. The Trump technology sanctions haven't slowed down China. On the contrary, as Allison and Schmidt aver, China is gaining on the US and in some fields has overtaken it. Both for economic and strategic reasons, the Biden administration is likely to give Trump's failed China policy a decent burial and move on.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guests, Brother Ayman Rizvi and Ali Alevian. Assalamu alaikum to both of these dear guests.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So in the series of the program, Viewpoints, we are mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei. One important topic which has been tackled by him on different occasions and his speeches is the position of human being and how important it is in Islam. We know that Islam has a type of special and specific look at the position of human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's why when we are talking about human, we are not talking about the humanistic approach, something which was very much welcome in the Western world or secular world. We are talking about Islam, we are talking about Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt's viewpoints regarding human beings. Imam Khamenei also, on different occasions, tackled this issue. Brother Ali Alevian, what's your take on that? We pay attention to, ahkam and aqaid, the rulings which are considered about what is halal, what is haram, how to do wajibat, okay, what are the beliefs in our system. But what about the akhlaqi part of the life of the human beings?
Yeah, actually, spiritualities have an important role in our lives, and we cannot actually ignore their role in life. In case we delete and remove and omit spirituality from our life, so nothing will exist from our, from our personality and human being's personality, because human being is in need of a sort of, supplication, prayer with the Creator.
That's right.
So where are they discussed? They are discussed in actually akhlaqi sessions, akhlaqi meetings, and human beings are always in need of a person to guide them and advise them.
So one beautiful example. So regarding akhlaq, see how Imam Hussein alayhi salam behaved the army of the enemy on that time, not stopping them the water, that before reaching to Karbala, the army of the enemy reached a place that Imam Hussein alayhi salam had full control over the water of the river, but he led them to our water. This is the akhlaq we can learn from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We can see during history and the influences that he had in his speeches here and there on his companions and also some of the members of the army of the enemy. They left the army and joined the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. His interactions with Zuhair, Zuhair ibn Ghain, all of these beautiful examples of the lifestyle of the infallible Imams, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, show us that how much akhlaq and ma'naviyah, ethics and morality and also spirituality can sometimes help the human beings. But it needs practice, Brother Ali, doesn't it?
Sorry?
Ethics and akhlaq needs practice.
Very true. Without practice, nothing actually, the result of it cannot be seen.
Okay.
So we need to first have a trainer, a ustad. We need to actually follow the instructions by a reliable and actually trusted staff, then out of, let's say, practices, inshallah, they will be institutionalized in us, and we can, inshallah, become a practitioner.
Okay, that's right. And say they may raise me, especially for our kids and children, this akhlaqi education, because the parents are responsible for their ethical training. But I think it's very good to have one ustad or we can say master of akhlaq outside of the family to train the child, isn't it?
Well, I think it's not. I think it's personal. It's a personal view.
Okay.
I don't. Since I do homeschooling for my kids.
Oh, so you do homeschooling.
I personally don't think that you always need a person out of the family.
Okay.
If parents are good enough, you know, and they are, you know,
this is important.
Yeah, if they have trained, you know, good enough, then they can do it. They can do many of the things themselves. But of course, they can take examples from other scholars or, you know, and present them to the children in a good, you know, interesting manner so that they can understand them.
Yes.
But it's not like it's not necessary. I think personally, I don't think it's very necessary.
Because sometimes the parents themselves
are, they are the teacher.
In need. No, sometimes they are in need of akhlaqi points.
They do.
Okay.
Yeah, they do.
And they found themselves. I do want to say sometimes the akhlaq is needs an expertise. Sometimes, because we know that the parents nowadays, sometimes we can find in the Muslim lands too, are busy with their works. They have jobs outside. They do not have time to spend with the child, okay? So who's going to be responsible for the akhlaq of the child, of the kid in the house?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. You have a comment on that?
Yeah. Actually, for when we are talking about an akhlaqi trainer, it does not mean that all of the brothers or sisters who are listening to us need to go and find somebody to teach them to do this and to do that. This is the promise of God. In case we actually oblige ourselves towards whatever is haram and whatever is wajib, muharramat and wajibat, whatever is compulsion, whatever is prohibited, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He will Himself pave the way for us to go towards other phases of that.
That's right.
As the brother said, and this trainer is not necessarily, for example, an ustad from Hawza Almiya. No. Mm-hmm. It can be a person, for example, inside the family, a person, a good role model inside the family. It can be a mother or father. Whoever, for example, is more closer to this quite clear, let's say, instruction that we talked about. That is, obliging ourselves towards performing wajibat, that is, compulsory actions, and refraining from what is known to be prohibited actions.
Okay.
So it's I think a simple rule that brings us famous quote again is from Ayatollah Bajat when he said that when you oblige yourself to these two actions, the rest will come to you. Allah will guide you by His own mercy to help you find the right way. Whether in the, let's say, words of a father or a mother or, for example, a spiritual star or trainer or whoever. Because you have started your moral education by refraining from whatever is prohibited and actually oblige you to do whatever is wajib and compulsory.
That's
so,
right.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He will show us the way in case we become a bit strict on whatever He has asked us to do and He has asked us not to do.
That's all right. We cannot delete the role of spirituality in today's world. But the important case is that nowadays, Sayyid Ayman, we see so many spiritual movements around the world. I think sometimes we confuse the concept of spirituality with tranquility. For example, these new movements, the spiritual movements that are happening, the meditation ones, the yogas, okay? These are very different from the akhlaq and the manaviya that we are talking about. I think those movements are, again, concerned with the physical features of the human beings. I mean, at least it can bring kind of tranquility in your mind and mentality, and they call themselves the mental movements, but not the spirituality. What's your take on that, Bill?
Well, I think it's not exactly as you said. I think it's there are little bit differences. As
yes.
I followed one sadhu, you know sadhu?
No.
He's a
Hindu
mentor.
One?
Yeah, Hindu one, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So he has a YouTube channel.
Yes,
you know, so I've watched a few of his videos.
Okay.
So most of the videos, they had a common teachings.
Okay.
And they were guiding people towards this divine power.
Yes.
And, you know, but on certain elements, like, were wrong, such as evolution.
Mm-hmm.
We don't believe in evolution. Yes. And, you know, so they had, they brought this idea of evolution somehow.
Yes.
But still, we all know that God has sent many prophets in all around the world. But unfortunately, what happened that all those teachings were hijacked.
Uh-huh.
By some people.
Yes.
They changed them into something different else.
Okay.
And now I think Hinduism is also very much related, you know, it's very close in its,
yes,
teaching with Islam.
Yes.
Same as Christianity.
Okay.
Same as the Judaism.
Okay.
Yeah, they were all divine religions.
Yes.
Initially.
Yes.
But they were all hijacked, and they were tarifat, you know, they changed it. They changed their holy books.
Yes.
And brought us, you know, in front of people in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have this problem right now. But I think,
okay,
you're right. There are some movements, some spiritual movements,
yes,
which are wrong.
Okay,
yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. So the right path and the true path was shown to us through the Holy Quran, through the teachings of Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt. But the only thing is that we have to practice it every day, on and on.
Mm.
And then this practice kind of makes us perfect. Practice makes perfect, as the English people say.
And moreover, brother, I have heard one of the instructions that one of the teachers
trainers.
Of Akhlaq, one of the teachers of Akhlaq said that alongside with whatever that is quite known in Hadith and in the conduct of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, that we have to oblige ourselves to wajibat, that is compulsory actions, and refraining from muharramat, that is prohibited actions.
Mm-hmm.
One more action helps us to, inshallah ta'ala, find our duties, spiritual duties.
Yes.
And actually act upon, that is recitation of the Holy Quran.
Okay.
Recitation of the Holy Quran, pondering on the verses of the Quran. Not necessarily all the verses that we recite every day, because we, as inshallah, a believer, need to recite at least 50 verses of the Holy Quran each day. But not all the verses. I'm pondering, let's say, focusing even on one single verse of the Holy Quran each day, actually will open horizons of ma'rifah and knowledge and inshallah,
yes,
spirituality towards our heart, and it will revolutionize,
that's
inshallah,
right,
our life and our spiritual aspect.
That's
of
right.
Life.
Doing our salat on time and safeguarding our salat is also another important topic, you know, which is really important. As you said, recitation,
mm-hmm,
of the Holy Quran can also help,
because again,
us. I'm pondering upon
in
that.
In Quran, everything is there, because the salat that you are talking,
yes,
is again in Quran,
yeah,
pondering in the verses of salat. Again,
yes,
Ahlul Bayt are in Quran.
Yes.
So we cannot actually
we cannot miss it.
Take,
that's right,
take out Ahlul Bayt from Quran. They are the whole Quran, most of verses of the Holy Quran,
mm-hmm,
actually are about the status and position of Ahlul Bayt alayhim. So everything is in Quran. The akhlaqiyat and al-ahkam, akhlaq, everything, jurisprudence, our businesses, whatever we need in our,
right, okay,
in daily lives are in Quran.
And the rulings are over there, but not the mere recitation and memorization of the Holy Quran can help us.
Exactly.
We have to practice them, we have to ponder upon them, and we have to apply them in our lives. This application is very important, because we have the theoretical aspect of the Holy Quran and the applied one. What about the applied ones, okay?
Mm.
Theoretically, okay, we are good reciters, we are good memorizers of the Holy Quran, we send the kids to their school to memorize the whole Quran under, what, 12? Okay, this is good. But what about practicing it in our lives? We have to practice it as the parents in the house, so then the Holy Quran is going to for sure help us, inshallah.
Mm.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, brother.
Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, it was very kind of you. Nice elaboration on some of the main features of human beings as tackled by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And thank you much, dear listeners. This is Real Points. I'm Atan, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube page and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. May Allah bless you all. Do not forget us in your du'as. Fi amanallah.
ever say when I'm too concerned by what they say? Why should I when I have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
This city is surrounded by flames. Underground, there are tales of heroism and fear for the future. Little had prepared any of us on the Athens-bound flight for the sight of the great fire-induced clouds that swept either side of the plane as it made its descent on Friday, 6th of August. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Helena Smith. The piece is titled, Apocalyptic Scenes Hit Greece as Athens Besieged by Fire. City is surrounded by flames. Underground, there are tales of heroism and fear for the future. Little had prepared any of us on the Athens-bound flight for the sight of the great fire-induced clouds that swept either side of the plane as it made its descent on Friday, 6th of August. News of the extreme heat engulfing Greece had spread beyond its borders all week, packaged in increasingly desperate language. Temperatures were breaking records few had ever imagined. If Monday was bad, then Tuesday was worse. In some parts of the country, the mercury had hit 47 degrees Celsius, 117 degrees Fahrenheit, with thermal cameras on drones recording the ground temperature in downtown Athens at 55 degrees Celsius. By Wednesday, 4th of August, we were hearing that entire tracts of suburban forests on the Greece capital's northern fringes had gone up in flames. Infernos seemingly redolent of Dante's hell had incinerated everything in their path. Friends had lost homes. Thousands of people had been evacuated, with residents and tourists fleeing blighted zones by any means possible. Terraces and Athenians' respite against the blazing heat had been transformed into ash-laden no-go zones. It's been crazy over here. Between the extreme heat and the wildfires, it feels apocalyptic. Eleni Myrivili, a friend recently appointed to the role of Athens' first chief heat officer, wrote in an email on Thursday as the army was deployed to assist firefighters. Ash is raining down on us here in Athens. From the sky, it was frighteningly clear that the city was under siege, caught in a cycle of insufferable heat, fueling conflagrations on terrain so parched it was ready to ignite at any moment. Fires, some big, some small, some extinguished and then rekindled, were raging nationwide, the country's civil protection chief, Nikos Hardalias, told reporters. Conditions were not only extremely dangerous but unprecedented, he said, estimating that firefighters trying to protect populated areas, electricity installations and historic sites had battled 154 wildfires over the space of just 1 week. More than 60 conflagrations were still raging on Saturday, 7th of August. Over the past few days, we have been facing a situation without precedent in our country in the intensity and wide distribution of the wildfires and the new outbreaks all over Greece, he said. I want to assure you that all forces available are taking part in the fight. Under skies of acrid smoke so dense, authorities urge residents to wear face masks outdoors and close windows in their homes. Other nations, including Britain, have stepped up to help this weekend, dispatching waterbombing planes, firefighters and vehicles to Athens. Although temperatures had dropped after 11 days of exceeding 40 degrees Celsius, winds also picked up on Friday, fanning new flashpoints in and around Athens. Saturday, 7th of August, a huge blaze that had burned through forests and houses towards Lake Marathon, Athens' main reservoir, was advancing up the slopes of Mount Parnitha, surrounding a national park regarded as Athens' last substantial green lung, and sending yet more choking smoke across the Attica Basin. On Evia, the island east of the capital, where wildfires have also rampaged from west to north across rugged woodland, dramatic scenes unfolded as ferries, tourist boats and fishermen rushed to evacuate more than 1,000 people from seaside villages and beaches. Men and women could be seen clutching babies and carrying the elderly and vulnerable on chairs as they boarded the ships to safety. Further south in the Peloponnese, emergency services struggled for a fifth straight day to contain wildfires that have destroyed large parts of Ilia and Messenia and threatened ancient Olympia, where the Olympic flame is lit every 4 years. Mindful of the huge loss of life from wildfires that tore through the seaside resort of Marti in the summer of 2018, the Greek government has prioritized evacuations. Two deaths linked to the latest wildfires have so far been reported. One victim was a volunteer firefighter and the other, Konstantinos Michalos, the British-educated head of the Athens Chamber of Commerce and Industry, who was found dead after rushing to his factory as a devastating wildfire advanced on Krioneri, a suburb in northeast Athens. Greece's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, that climate change was clearly to blame for temperatures that have turned the country into a powder keg and sparked infernos described as the worst in decades in neighboring Turkey and Italy. Athens is the hottest metropolis in mainland Europe, with meteorologists predicting that annual mean temperatures across the Mediterranean Sea will increase by up to 2 degrees Celsius over the next 30 years. But in the midst of darkness wrought by nature gone awry, extraordinary stories of valor also emerged last week. Faced with the prospect of his home in Thraco Macedones in the foothills of Mount Parnitha being razed by fire at 3 a.m. on Saturday, Alexandros Rizos decided to stay on and defend his property. His wife and child safely evacuated. The 55-year-old business development consultant stood on the roof of the two-story building, hosing his garden and the tops of pine trees in anticipation of the blaze approaching. "I'm very attached to this house," said Alexandros Rizos, an avid marathon runner, recounting the drama which took place after four sleepless nights. "I hid when the order arrived to evacuate, and when the fire came, it came like a typhoon, raining gold everywhere. I was there alone and very frightened, but I had also taken every measure. I had cleared the garden, removed pine cones. The typhoon lasted for about 4 minutes, but the grass outside and the treetops were wet enough for the fire to pass over." The appearance of the firefighters minutes later and his own heroic efforts saved the entire neighborhood from being reduced to cinders. Like many, Rizos believes the climate emergency will only get worse. "We're ecologists, we love nature in my family, and we want to protect the environment, not install air conditioners that will destroy it. But with temperatures of 45 degrees Celsius, that's going to be hard. We have to adapt, for sure. I'm replacing pine trees with other trees that don't burn so easily." Mairivili fears the effects of the destruction of so much forest around Athens. Mount Parnitha is a hub for biodiversity and home to some of Europe's richest flora and fauna. "These mountains around Athens are our life support," she said, describing the challenge to mitigate heat as a battle of all battles now confronting Greece. "We've taken a huge step back. A vital part of our green infrastructure has gone. With all these trees no longer there, we'll be faced with new climate conditions and have higher temperatures and likely floods in the metropolitan area of Athens for years to come."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.